Jackson, right? Elected in item 40. No, no, he wasn't. He was robbed in item 40. John Quincy Adams was elected. Why? Why was it that the man with the most electoral votes and the most popular vote, and the only one with electoral and popular votes from all regions of the country, lost?
He went to the Senate, right? Or was he going to the House?
Because he did not win the majority, and in the House,
yeah, he lost in the House.
He lost in the House, and we can pretty well assume because of whose influence? Henry Clay, who held what position in the House?
House
Speaker of the House. Who's our current Speaker of the House?
What's his face?
What's his face? Yeah, yeah. There's an old basketball coach from Illinois. He's the one that said that why would anybody rebuild New Orleans? And then later said, well, I didn't mean that. Dennis Hastert. Well, you're not running for election like you are. So Henry Clay influenced the vote so that John Quincy Adams would become president. That caused the one party at that time, Jefferson's Democrat-Republican Party, to splinter. And it was clearly the end of the era of good feelings because they didn't feel so good about that event. And eventually this split in the party, which started in 1824, will bloom into two completely new different political parties by the 1828 rerun election. So those factions that become parties in that four-year period are listed in 41. Jackson and Van Buren, as well as John C. Calhoun, who we haven't talked about but need to, will form the current Democratic Party. So the Democrats of today trace their origin back to the 18... Well, they try to trace their origin back to Jefferson, like everybody does, but the reality is the party as it is today got its start between 1824 and 28 under the leadership of Andrew Jackson. And its purpose for the existing was to make it fair for the country to finally get the White House where it belongs, where people voted, their argument. John C. Calhoun, South Carolina politician who had been Secretary of War for Monroe and a war hawk, was the running mate of Jackson, both in 24 and again in the rerun in 28. What's also a bit of ironic significance is he didn't lose. He was elected vice president in 1824, so he served with John Quincy Adams as an opposition leader. So you can definitely tell how that was not a harmonious relationship. The other wing of the, or faction of the party, changed the name from Democrat Republicans to National Republicans. So Democrats and National Republicans. By the mid-1830s, they would change their name again to the Whigs, but it's the same party of the same faction. They include the President, John Quincy Adams, his Secretary of State, the heir to the throne, Henry Clay, and prominent Massachusetts politician Daniel Webster, who was the lawyer in the Dartmouth case that we talked about. Now, these two factions did not, in those 4 years, encompass large numbers of people and voters. It wasn't like all of a sudden there was gigantic rallies of thousands and thousands of people. What you really see is still, in the minds of most people, if they're even paying attention to politics at all, there's still one party, but somebody's mad at somebody. And it's after 1828 that we start to see more firmly fixed party bases built throughout the country. So it's really the split is top-down rather than grassroots up. But John Quincy Adams president, and we mentioned the things he accomplished as a Secretary of State, which will be far more stellar than his presidential times. What Clay had liked about John Quincy Adams's policy was that it was, in many ways, refried Hamiltonianism. It was the idea of high protective tariffs, a strong national bank, a strong role for the national government in economic policy. Something I had not mentioned earlier, I looked at, was the creation of a national road. I left it out because it's not on the test, and here I am lurching back to the bar and going through what I tried to square off. But an example of nationalism in the economic policy was the government built what would be, in today's terms, an interstate road, an interstate highway, starting from Annapolis, Maryland, and moving all the way eventually out to St. Louis, built by federal monies. And in the, as the road inched further westward across, there were all kinds of fights and debates about whether or not the federal government could repair it, add extensions to it. And there were debates that if part of the road that was going to be extended lie with entirely one state, that was the responsibility of the state, not the federal government. Adams was a strong proponent of letting the federal government do all the road repairs and extensions, no matter how short or through what states it went through. He was also an advocate of a national university. This is where people thought he was like, you know, he used to call, isn't Governor of California, Jerry Brown, Moonbeam Brown, because he wanted to explore space way beyond the nine planets. Everybody thought he was kind of wacko for his, maybe he's just ahead of his time or something, but John Quincy Adams was perceived the same way as being kind of out of touch with reality, that we would spend tax dollars on a college, creating a national university, which he argued would be wonderful for agricultural and industrial research. He said, if we're going to follow Hamilton's dream of building up a strong, productive society that outsells Europe, we need to commit our resources and our scientists to get the greatest technology and research. And that was just considered a waste of money and definitely not the role for government to be involved in. That should be left to the private market, private sector. Other things about John Quincy Adams which are not as vitally important for either test or for policy, and he said that he swam nude in the Potomac for his health, and at center of centers, he played billiards upstairs in the White House. Yeah. And outside of that, and a couple of tariffs, there's not much that the John Quincy Adams presidency embodied. There was all, well, I forgot this, there was some good relations with Panama that paid off in future directions. Few knew about it. Tariffs, though. In 1824, a tariff that was even higher than 1816 was passed with Adams urging. Remember, the 1816 one was the first high protective tariff, so this is even higher. Between 1824 and 28, one of the things about these two parties, these two factions that become parties, is they start to, the Democrats and the National Republicans, they start to stake out clear positions on the role of government and business. I'm going to have to kind of talk my way into this one. I'm not exactly sure where I'm coming from. But if we go back to the ancient days, Jefferson and Hamilton, the Jefferson approach was a complete laissez-faire attitude. Government should stay out of business, not help, not hurt, not regulate, not tax, not dictate. If any governing has to take place, it's preferred to be state and local, but best of all would be private market when it comes to business. Where we know Hamilton and the Federalists were very interventionist and helpful, the protective tariffs, the trying to give loans to the companies that could, the creation of the National Bank. So the big difference there was Jefferson was laissez-faire, Hamilton was use government to intervene. With the Federalists evaporating in the teens, what had kind of happened was Jeffersonians such as Madison and Monroe still claimed to be the party of laissez-faire while they built the National Road, created the new tariff, recharted the new bank, built up fortifications. So they sang and danced laissez-faire, but enacted policies, which was quite big government business. This is where Jackson says it's time to get back to Jeffersonian roots, protect states' rights, reduce the role of the government in business, and pursue laissez-faire. So Jefferson is the one who starts to really, and he's doing this because this is in opposition to Adams' policies. He wants to win re-election in 1828. He sees John Quincy Adams and Clay just mimicking Hamiltonian federalism ever more so in the 1820s. So he figures that's where he can find a position to get elected. Maybe today's Democrats could take a page from that. That if they want to get, if they want to win some midterm elections or future presidential election, they need to have some policies that are different than what Republicans advocate. Like Republicans did in 1994 with the contract on air. So this was Jackson's approach. And, not surprising, the National Republicans, who heartfelt believe this, continued to advance, pursue, and promote big government business policy. So by 1828, there are issue differences, there's policy differences, laissez-faire versus interventionism. Also in 1828, another tariff occurs. And this is kind of an odd duck. It's going to be called the Tariff of Abominations. People who were mad at the first two tariffs, 1816 and 1824, argued it was time to reduce tariffs. This is way too much protectionism. People who liked the tariffs wanted the tariff change too. They wanted it increased. When the 1828 tariff was passed, those who wanted the tariff reduction were disappointed to see an increase. But those who wanted a tariff increase were also disappointed to see that rates had risen not on finished goods from abroad, but also resources from abroad. So the 1828 tariff somehow, why it got passed as a mystery, seemed to be hated by everybody, kind of like the Medicare bill or something. Everybody seemed to be upset with the 1828 tariff. And it took on the nickname, the Tariff of Abominations. And it's not surprising that it becomes a political football in the 1828 presidential election. Interesting thing I read about the Jackson forces is that knowing there was no CNN or wire services, Jackson went to northern states and where he knew there was pro-tariff industrial support, advocated that he would protect and increase the tariff. Then he went to southern states and decried what a terrible abomination the 28 tariff was. Didn't have to pay for it. Won on that issue. So all these politicians can reign again. South Carolina was profoundly disgusted with the tariff. And that is very true for South Carolina's leading son, Calhoun, John C. Calhoun. Now, Calhoun had been in his earlier career, as I said, a nationalist. And he chartered the second bank. He even in the early teens advocated higher tariffs. He did so because he anticipated with all the cotton grown in South Carolina that eventually cotton textile mills would locate there. So it wouldn't just be North New England mills, but it would be Southern mills too. He was about a century late on that. It wouldn't be until the 20th century that we start to see more cotton mills relocating in the South. So when it became obvious that all that South Carolina is going to make its money doing is growing the cotton and sending it to England or sending it to northern states, he then switched his positions and opposed tariffs and became a states' rights advocate and argued against big national economic policies. So while nobody knew it at the time, the document I'm about to describe was ghostwritten by Calhoun. South Carolina's legislature put forth a proclamation called the Exposition and Protest, in which it, and it's a familiar song, we can almost all sing along together on it, since states created the federal government, states, if they so wish, can nullify unconstitutional federal law. This is the Jefferson-Madison seed that they had planted there. So South Carolina, in 1828, is declaring that it could, not that it is, but that it could legally nullify the Tariff of Abominations. Once again, the legislature issues it, and it wouldn't be until about a year and a half later that it becomes known that John Calhoun ghost wrote it. Why should that bring up any kind of... Yeah, I mean, the second highest executive officer, his job would be to enforce federal law, is writing a document saying that you can nullify federal law, which... Exactly what Jefferson did in 1798 as a vice president too, right? So there's the role model to follow. And so that looms over the election. So there is the tariff. There is the campaigning for and against the tariff in different regions of the country. There is the exposition and protest, threat of nullification. That's also looming over the election. And then there's the whole, you know, re-elect Gore in 2004 type thinking going on, which could have happened. The idea that Jackson really was the winner all along and should be elected in 28. To make the 28 election even more exciting, the JQA forces, and this is not John Quincy Adams himself, at least his fingerprints aren't on this, but somebody in his campaign organization,
the committee to re-elect,
searched about and found out that Jackson's wife, Rachel Ward Jackson, and he, prior to their getting married, she had been married to someone else who had just run off and ditched her. And so rather than go through all the proper procedures of divorce and everything, she just When I used to coach Quiz Bowl at Northside, we threw a pretty arrogant and won most of the tournaments we played. But every once in a while, we'd go out of town and play a tournament and lose in the first round. We just slithered back, no news coverage, and just didn't even go to that tournament. And that was kind of the way they handled Rachel's first marriage. Just didn't even happen. So, and that had been hidden history for, I mean, the closest family and friends knew it, but nobody talked about it. But hidden history until the 1828 election, when the National Republican Party starts to campaign against Jackson, who's married to a bigamist.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't hurt Jackson with Chris Dixon, but it hurt Rachel. And she became so distraught over it that she got ill. And in fact, by the time the election died. So in Jackson's mind, who could carry a grudge very easily for a long, long time. Yeah, the other party, the dirty, rotten party politics that killed his wife. The party that should have been won 4 years ago. And he blamed JQA personally. When he really, I don't know if he should have or not, other operatives were involved. I guess if JQA didn't denounce it. But anyway, Jackson still wins the election anyway. Wins because of the strong popular uprising. It's between 24 and 28, the idea that the common man should be more enfranchised illustrates itself at the polls as the popular vote is counted again, still not legally binding, but it can't help but have had a strong influence on electors who looked at where the popular vote from the states went and followed suit. So Jackson won the 1828 election, becoming the first president to west of the Appalachians to be elected. And in his campaign, he had emphasized the fact that he was born in a log cabin, de-emphasized the fact that he was a wealthy slave owning plantation man. Dressed in Western frontier regalia, talked a lot about his war experience in the Battle of New Orleans, made a campaign trail with a lot of common fellow Indian fighters in order to really emphasize the patriotic common man type imagery. And it was a successful campaign. It was something that long after Jackson, people continued to mimic. Future candidates all wanted to fall over themselves to guarantee that they were born in a log cabin and came from common birth. Both parties, National Republicans, Whigs, and Democrats, could do that. In fact, one could say that in 1840, Tipper Canoe, William Henry Harrison, out-Jacksoned the Democrats by doing a better job of it. Daniel Webster, who had served in so many capacities, Secretary of State and Senator and presidential candidate on numerous occasions, when asked why he never made it to the presidency, he said, "I just wasn't fortunate enough to have been born poor in a log cabin." That's his way of explaining it. Yes.
Andrew Jackson, my family has records. We actually came from one of the mistresses that he had. We have records. He had 11 children from mistresses, and he was like the great grandpa.
Proud heritage there.
He in the book he said he has one daughter,
uh-huh.
She was adopted.
Oh.
So he had 11 from other
ones. Well, I had read somewhere, in the possible defense of Jackson, I had read somewhere that because of the lack of availability of traveling preachers, that many times could have been short-term marriages dissolved before anything formal happened because it might be years before a formal marriage could be made. So he may have been involved in two or three proto-marriages.
Yeah.
It could have been official marriages before Rachel, and we're not being fair to him. Is that a stretch? Or?
Yeah. She's a man.
Yeah.
Wow. Reminds me of something.
Years
ago, I was talking to a student, two students were talking, and one was talking about why were there so many negative, derogative terms about women of the evening, and yet there doesn't seem to be anything about men. And one of the students, a female, said, "Man says it all. They don't need the extra names." Anyway.
I think that was good. Very good. It is interesting.
It takes two?
Yeah, I
can. Supply and
demand.
There's a lot of women that are just as bad as any man.
It's all men, but a lot of women, right?
Like they said, it takes two.
Okay. Well, anyway, so Jackson's victory signals his success for, I guess I'd say, the Western Uprising. It's called the Revolution of 1828 by some because of a lot of political democratizing changes that follow Jackson into office. Your book, I think, has it. The chapter where it starts off talking about the inauguration of Jackson, in which his old frontier buddies with him show up and they go into the inaugural and start dancing and swinging and curtains. And
yep.
The only way you can get rid of them is to spike punch bowl and drag it out on the lawn so they follow. And then here's all these snooty elitist New Englanders, office holders, just shocked and dismayed that this king mob has come to rule Washington. But I, to some degree, I think he courted that image on purpose. And when I read that the first time in your book years ago, I later was reminded of it when Clinton won and went to Washington and had the Beijing ball and the one just for people from Arkansas. It's almost like that same in-your-face attitude against the luster of the Reagan-Bush years was being purposely played out. I think Jackson's doing the same thing. But there was a purposeful effort by Jackson to suggest that socially, politically, and economically, the common, it wasn't Jeffersonian ideals anymore, that someday the common man can rule. It was the day it came. But the common man now was in charge of Washington, even though he was actually a plantation slave elite person that wasn't really cultured. There's political as well as social reforms that are called Jacksonian democracy. And the political changes, which are listed in A through F of 43, they can rightly be associated with Jackson's heart. I would say that most of everything in that item lineup is something that Jackson himself embraced and, if he lived long enough, would have been party to. The social reforms, which are just hinted at in item 45, such things as women's rights and the abolition of slavery and those things, they are also considered to be a product of Jacksonian democracy, but they sure shouldn't get credit for it. Jackson couldn't give a flip about the social equality of people outside of the white males, and so while it's considered part of the whole era of Jacksonian democracy, it sure isn't something he himself endorsed or sponsored. And we'll talk about the political reforms now and touch on a few of the social reforms on the last page of our sheet here. Here are the things that I guess you could say from 1828 up to about 1840, these are the changes politically that take place in America. The first one, an A here, is that a number of state and local offices, which were once appointed, now became elected, either judges or licensing agencies. If an office is elected rather than appointed, he's clearly going to be selected by the people, and so it's more democratic. And that's the theme here, that each of these things involves more voice of the people in the selection process. Item B, the relaxation of voter qualifications. This is where every state eventually drops off property and church membership as a requirement. It's in the spirit of egalitizing people, but it's also in the spirit of, if we're the party that's recognized as the one that fought for relaxed voter qualifications, they'll vote for us in the next election. Like both parties in 1920, Democrats and Republicans, tried their best to claim they had got women to vote, so therefore they should be loyal to their party. Instead, what we find is that nearly at a 90% rate in the early elections after 1920, women voted exactly as husbands did. Item C, this is a really significant one. This is where the way presidential electors vote, the way the presidential electoral college will perform itself, that's what it's there, will change to a more democratic way. Prior to the Jacksonian democracy period, prior to the 1830s, state legislators chose electors. Electors went off in December, cast their votes. And it's very likely that the opinions of the public mattered nothing to them, and those electors are never even known. No matter how many electors have we ever met. Like leprechauns. Actually, there are some. I've met one. But it's hard to know one now. I think what it must have been like prior to the 1830s. So there clearly was a group of people, special people chosen to choose the presidency that were far removed from the common voters' opinions. that will start to change. We mentioned the fact that in 1824 and in 1828, the popular vote was counted, not legally binding, but counted. By the 1832 election onward, both two major political parties, Democrats and National Republicans, will have come to an unwritten agreement that whoever wins the plurality of the popular vote in a state wins all the electors of that state, winner take all of the state. So both parties now, not state legislature, but both parties would select someone who will be an elector and then watch the popular vote. And whoever gained that plurality, not necessarily majority, but just plurality, the greatest of the split, that party gets to cast all the electoral votes. Now that has been political tradition since the 1830s. It's not constitutional law. It's, I think, in 24 states, it's state law, but the other states do it just by volunteerism. But it's not part of the Constitution, it's just part of the traditional agreement of the two parties. So at that point, you become not the winner of the Electoral College, you become the winner of several state elections. In the case now, it's 51 elections. So I may have said all this before, but typically, I mean, as many years as I watched elections, I guess you have to lose the hard one before you wake up to what's going on, but as many years as I watched elections, it wasn't until 2000, and then clearly again 2004, that it dawned on me that when you see who's ahead 45% to 46% in the polls, it doesn't mean a lot unless you're looking at 51 polls, who's ahead in given states, because that's where it really makes the difference in values. Another aspect of the presidential election that was democratized during the Jackson years is item D. You may recall how candidates were selected prior to 1824 by a caucus, and how Van Buren tried to pull a fast one in 1823 and get William H. Crawford nominated at a poorly attended caucus. Instead of just the top few party elites meeting behind closed doors in smoke-filled rooms like hack politicians to select the candidates, speaking of that, are you a West Wing watcher? There was a scene where Josh and the guy that had the heart attack, Leo. Yeah, Josh and Leo were talking about who were going to be the candidates for the Democrats, and they reminisced what happened to the days of the smoke-filled rooms when party bosses made the decisions for everybody, and they looked at each other and said, that's us. That's who we are right now. Reminiscent of that. Anyway, the choosing of a candidate in that fashion changed to conventions. The use of a delegated nominating convention to select the candidate arises in 1832 and becomes the standard that both parties will use until the current day. So instead of a few elite party bosses and a caucus choosing the candidate, instead it would be where delegates from all over the country attend a convention. And at the convention, they choose the candidate. Now, by mid-20th century, by post-World War II 20th century, another step was firmly in place, and what's that? When was the last time? Do you ever remember seeing a convention choose a candidate that you weren't sure it was going to be? No, I don't think that's happened since the 50s. It's happened. So what's determined well ahead of time? Primaries. Presidential primaries, which started in 1912 and were not legally binding until 1972. But by after World War II, it was pretty obvious that if you won the primary delegates, you were in the lead to the point that others dropped out by the time you got to the convention. So it's even more democratized now. My argument would be, if you want to make a really fair, democratized primary system, make all states hold them on the same day. So instead of Iowa and New Hampshire picking our candidates, we all have to think for ourselves. That would be that. Especially if it's a real dice throw, you might end up with a what? Who? Howard Dean? Oh no, I was just teasing. I was a Dean fan, but there was that slight fear that what if he wins? But anyway, so the delegated nominating conventions that first started in 1832 was the more democratic step towards selecting the candidate beyond just caucus methods. Item E, political parties, which we know arose in 1790, now become more grassroots based. It's not going to be just top a few elite people that know they're even in a party and do things. If you're going to win elections by turning out voters, and if there are more voters because of relaxed voter qualification, you're going to have to reach the people. I mean, you can talk about tariffs and road building and bank rechartering, but if you want to get elected, you better talk about what? Who slept with whom and waved that flag. That's what that's what the voters care about. And so therefore we see kind of a common denominator lowering of the bar in terms of what became the campaign approach for political parties. I don't want to say dumbing down the issues, that's not it, but bringing the issues more in touch with the tastes and desires of the common narrative. And one of the ways to do that is, say for example, I or some friends of mine, I have to be influential people in Northwest Arkansas, and we can turn out a few extra thousand votes, and we know other people who can do so also. What might encourage me to get those common voters out?
Right.
A job label in Washington? You bet. So therefore, we'll see the rise of what? The spoil system, or patronage, where people who, they get rewarded in favors for turning out the vote by getting a government job, which may or may not be what they're qualified for. So, I mean, when people scream about Harriet Myers, think about the whole Jackson era. This is where this starts. The rewarding of, in fact, the expression first came from William H. Marcy, who was like Secretary of War, I think, which the highest man in New York is named, William H. Marcy, when asked about why are some of these really uneducated nincompoops suddenly holding important jobs in Washington, jobs that used to be by well-trained Federalists from New England, knew what they were doing, like Postmaster General, etc. Marcy's comment was, to the victor goes the spoils. And so in fact he said, this is an obligation, this is democracy at work. We owe back to the people because they paid off in votes, that's democracy. So it starts in the Jackson years. Now, about one-third of Washington bureaucrats were changed out through the spoils system and patronage of the Jackson years. By the 1880s and 1870s and 1880s, it had grown to be nearly 80% of everybody changing over. So while Jackson and the Democrats started it, Republicans in the latter half of the 19th century perfected it so well that they passed a law, which you don't have to know, called the Pendleton Act, which said you have to take a test and show you can read and write to hold a job in Washington. But the best in terms of patronage and spoils has to be the Democrats in the 20th century, from the 1930s all the way to the 1970s, 60s at least. And why would those parties be trading back and forth with who's better at the spoils system? One party more ethical than the other? No, they were winning presidential elections. So my theme here is they were all doing it. They just kept doing it more and more. That's the nature of, if you keep winning the presidency, you're the one who can give out the jobs. So that started in the Jackson years, the spoils system. Item 44, another feature of Jacksonian democracy, which I guess I could have listed as GH and I, et cetera, but they're of a little bit different nature. There are things about Jackson himself. Jackson was the first president to exert a strong, purposeful, assertive presidency. From Washington all the way up to John Quincy Adams, while they performed their duties, and Washington was a pretty strong president, there was always this kind of a feeling like, we've got to be careful not to be too assertive for fear that we're acting monarchical, a monarch endangers freedom and democracy. So presidents should be administrative caretakers whose job is to do what Congress passed. Yeah, if the Congress appropriates a bill to do something, the president carries out. If it doesn't, the president behaves himself because there's no need for presidential action. Jackson, on the other hand, became a very strong, assertive, powerful president, stretching the powers of the presidency. Sometimes, oddly, though not in a power way, he often vetoed a lot of laws, arguing that he had to hold back government. He had to be the strong member of government to prevent government from doing too much. So it was a kind of a negative presidential power assertion. He was the first president to veto bills, not because of any constitutional reasons, because he says, I don't like them. It's not good for the people. And the people would argue, aren't you acting, you know, like a king, as the opposition party would rename itself, the Whig. And King Andrew I has to be checked by the Whig party. That's why he adopted that title. Jackson's argument was kind of this old man. The people who come from Northwest Arkansas, the people that come from Tennessee, the people that come from Maine, be they even senators, but especially congresspersons, what's their duty to their district, to their constituents? They don't give a flip about the neighboring states, the other regions of the country. They don't have to get reelected if they do. So everybody's looking out for only one section of the country. Who's looking out for the whole country? Nobody. Therefore, I, the president, have to be, in my own self, equally strong to all of Congress and protect all the country from all the selfish people trying to spend and waste money in their section of the country. And the only way I can do that is by vetoing as much stuff I don't like, because I represent everybody. That's why they elected me. So that was the Jackson view of the presidency. It was his responsibility, and the people expected him to do that. Jackson would also argue that the opposition party, National Republicans, or as they be called Whigs, represented the upper elite classes of America, and that the Democratic Party, which he was president, party leader of, represented the common ordinary man. So therefore, the only way to protect the common ordinary man from these rich, powerful elites is by being such a powerful president. Of course, back to the party name, the National Republicans, by the 1830s, arguing that the actions of Jackson represented a dangerous monarchical dictator, took on the title the Whig Party, because they say the common man must be protected from a king, so we Whigs will protect. So everybody's protecting the common man by political infighting against the other side. So that's what 44 was about. And as 45 shows, there was a slew of social reforms to occur in the 1830s and 40s, which are attributed to Jacksonian democracy, despite his lack of endorsement of that, which we'll get to later. Now in 46, I don't want to shock anybody, but we have a little bit of social scandal going on in Washington. It was the time, the way people were once. Here's what happens. Goes back to the election. After Jackson won, he's a widower because Rachel has died. He moves to Washington early. He doesn't take office, of course, till March 4th, but he moves to Washington shortly after the election. And Washington is not a very party town yet. It's just very few establishments there. And so he takes most of his meals at a tavern or a pub owned by the O'Neill family. One of his political appointees, Secretary of War, will be a bachelor named John Eaton. And so the two of them quite often dined at the O'Neill pub. And as it would be, young John Eaton struck up a friendship, which turned into a romance, with the daughter of the tavern owner, Peggy O'Neill. And they were married. After inauguration, it becomes known that Peggy O'Neill, tavern daughter, now married to Cabinet Secretary John Eaton, or Peggy Eaton, surprising to many as it's released here, had been married before John to a sailor named Timberlake. It was one of those weddings where Timberlake blew into town, romanced her, married her, took off, and never came back. So Peggy handled it like one of those tournaments that nobody heard of, you know? That one never happened. Just like the Rachel affair. Yet after taking office, rumor starts to spread that Peggy is a bigamist. And to make things worse, and by the way, then also rumors flourish that Timberlake, who had intended to come back to his bride, discovered that she had remarried and broke his heart and committed suicide out in the open seas. That's the story. Well, cabinet members, other appointees by Jackson, their wives all began to kind of form a social clique that left the Eatons out. So it's state parties and state functions and dinners, all the cabinet members and their wives would get together, and there would be John Eaton, Peggy Eaton, Andrew Jackson by themselves. Except for one. There was one person who made it a definite effort to come over and be friends with John and Andrew. Secretary of State Martin Van Buren. Martin Van Buren, who had known with Crawford having his stroke, that that's the end of his climb to power that direction, he had allied over with Jackson. And with being in the Secretary of State position was just a pretty choice. Two people were competing to be the heir to the throne. Vice President Calhoun, who had stayed loyal, and Martin Van Buren, Secretary of State, they both want to be the next president. They both want to please Jackson. Where Calhoun's problems occur is this. Of the cabinet wives, and the vice president's not a cabinet, but of the administrative wives who were snubbing the Eatons, the lead snub was Fluoride Calhoun, John Calhoun's wife. Fluoride, yeah. She's the one that kept all the other wives stirred up and angry at the Eatons because of the low social status of Peggy. So Jackson, who feels, you know, he feels for John because he went through this same garbage in the election earlier. Rachel's death is caused by this kind of rumor mongering and social snippety stuff. So he issues an executive order that at state parties and functions and dinners, all cabinet members and their wives will associate with the straight up executive order. But somehow the wives tend to have more authority than the president, so the snubbing continues. And then it got out. Everybody outside of Washington knew what was going on, what was the problem. And Van Buren comes to Jackson and says, you know, I like John and Peggy like you. They're great, great people. And it's a shame what's happening to him. But what's also happening is you're not getting anything done. You've lost your advisory body. You've got to do something to try to solve this problem. You don't want to hurt the Eaton's feeling. You need to get advisors you can work with. Jackson says, well, what's your suggestion? He says, well, how about this? Why don't you just ask for the resignation of every cabinet member, except those that, you know, that you want to get rid of anyway, replace them with people, except John and Peggy, send him off to something else. But since you're accepting more than just his, it won't look like he's the target of this. I'll even give mine up, just to show that I have no ambitions. And he says, well, what are we going to do with you if you're no longer Secretary of State? Because I don't mind being ambassador to Britain. He knows what he's doing is going to be so pleasing to Jackson, and Calhoun's going to be the jerk on this situation because of what happened. So that's what happens. He asks for mass resignations. He accepts them, sends the Eatons off to be a customs agent in, I think, Florida, fires other people. Van Buren is put up for an appointment to be ambassador to the court of St. James of Britain. But when it comes time, and he actually takes on the role in an acting capacity, but when it comes time for the confirmation of his appointment, it comes before, as we know, a Senate vote, and there's a tie. What happens in a tie in the Senate? Who's the vice president? Calhoun votes against confirmation because he's so mad at Van Buren for what's been going on, which was so stupid because that drove home the signal to Jackson. Poor, loyal Van Buren is the victim of political shenanigans, just like the Eagles were, about who Calhoun's. So that becomes the first great, the three things that create a great wedge between Calhoun and Jackson. The first one is the Peggy Eaton affair and the vote against confirmation for Van Buren's appointment. So Van Buren is kind of left still hanging around Washington is to do whatever bidding Jackson needs and ends up becoming his future vice president and president. The second thing that occurs, I said three things will occur to create a split between Jackson and Calhoun. The second one is the so-called Crawford Letter of 47. William H. Crawford, you recall him? Mm-hmm. Secretary of the Treasury for Monroe, one of the four presidential candidates in 1824 that suffered the stroke. He is no longer a serious, viable candidate for anything. He's in retirement. But he has a feeling for Van Buren. He wants to help out Van Buren's future now. Might be something he can kind of attach to and tag along with if the Van Buren rise to power comes about. So he writes a letter to Andrew Jackson, reminiscing Jackson's invasion of Florida back during the First Seminole War of 1817. He says, you remember when you hanged those British? And there was a lot of uproar about what you had done. Some even called for your court-martial. You assumed that it was Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, and there's been a lot of bad blood between you and JQA over the years, so you probably assumed as early as 1817 he's the one that called for your court-martial. Well, as Secretary of the Treasury, I sat in on a number of those meetings. And let me say, surprisingly here, JQA defended your actions, what you did to the British. It's your own friend John C. Calhoun that was calling for court-martial. Just thought you'd like to know. No evidence as to whether or not that was actually true or not, but it sure didn't sweeten the deal with Jackson. And the third event is a long, gnarly story about tariffs and the tariff of abomination. So we'll pick up with that and do item 48 onward, not Thursday, because you recall Thursday while you're relaxing and enjoying and probably having a dark beer. I spent 6 hours with parents at those times. So a week from tonight, we regather for 48 hours.